Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello and welcome to the Dom Harvey Podcast, brought to you by Radix and Generate. Coming up, Simon Bridges.
You know, I can remember on those plane trips, you know, just everything had gone wrong all week. You know, you knew that half your colleagues were trying to do you, and you might be sitting there just quietly by yourself, pretending you're sleeping, but wanting to cry, you know.
Bridges, former leader of the National Party and the first ever Māori to lead a major party in New Zealand. We cover a lot of ground here, the good, the bad and the ugly. Oh, and there is plenty of each. We chat about his very recent fall, very serious fall too, off a lime scooter, his early acting roles in Hercules, his law career, including his time as a Crown Prosecutor, and the toll that takes on a person's mental health. Then we get into the ugly, the politics, including his regular TV appearances with Jacinda Ardern at the very beginning of their careers and the on-screen chemistry they had, getting told off by then Prime Minister John Key, receiving death threats, being publicly mocked for how he speaks, his reflections on voting against gay marriage, life after politics, and much, much more. Simon is a real open book who doesn't gloss over anything, which I found really refreshing, and I genuinely hope you guys like this one, regardless of where you stand politically. Thank you so much to my friends at Radix and Generate for sponsoring this episode. Radix is a Waikato-based nutrition company who are going mainstream in a big way. Their protein powders are world-class. I start every single day with a shake made with their protein powder. And if you don't currently take protein powder, you should do some research, because chances are you could do with a lot more than what you're currently getting. And a shake with Radix protein powder is the best, easiest, and most effective way to get more. Check them out, radix.co.nz, and while you're there, take a look at their other products. Their freeze-dried meal range is insane. There is a reason these guys have a 4.9 rating from 1,600 reviews. They're just that hard to fault. radix.co.nz. This episode is also brought to you by Generate, the award-winning KiwiSaver specialist. When it comes to KiwiSaver, the majority of us probably signed up when we started working and then left it to run its course. But taking the time to make sure you're in the right fund and ensuring you're maximising your account could really improve your lifestyle in retirement. And that's where Generate can help. Generate have a team of KiwiSaver advisors across the country available to meet with you, chat through your options, and help you make sure your KiwiSaver investment is working for you. If you've never got KiwiSaver advice before, head to generatekiwisaver.co.nz/dom to request a no-obligation chat with one of their advisors. A copy of their product disclosure statement is available on their website. The issuer of the scheme is Generate Investment Management Limited. And of course, past performance does not guarantee future returns. That website again, generatekiwisaver.co.nz/dom. Okay, let's get into it. Simon Bridges on the Dom Harvey Podcast. Simon Bridges, welcome.
Way, it's so good to be with you. I feel like, I feel very privileged. I just, can you, like, I listened to the Martin Henderson one you did a little while ago, and you just started by gushing about him and how handsome he was and how there'd never been a bad photo. So if you could just say a few of those things about me as well, I'd love that.
I cannot lie.
but I
am a fan of yours. Like I met you for the first time, I think this is when you were leader of the National Party, and it was just happened to be in the bathroom at Spark Arena, the night of the music.
Golly.
A mutual friend of ours, Morgan, introduced us, and I thought he's a really nice guy, Simon Bridges.
Thank you.
And it reminded me of a quote from Michelle Obama. I'm probably going to cock this one up. But she said something like, people are always harder to dislike up close.
Yes. So you dislike me. You dislike me from it. No. I think that's right, and that's certainly true of politicians. I mean, we were just talking about it off air. You know, it's quite polarizing, right? You have to put your view out there, and you know, in any given day, if your view is X, there'll be 50% who have a view of Y, right? So, So that's always going to be challenging. I think I remember those the VA awards. Is that what they're called or whatever?
Yeah, VMAs,
VMA. Yeah. I remember being at those. They take particular courage because any kind of entertainment event, if you're a centre right politician, you know, like 73% of them freaking hate you, right? They're going to come up to you and have you on, and you know about your policy on this or that. It's amazing how political kind of the creative sectors are. So I went in with trepidation and my
stamp proof vest.
Yes, and my fears were not misplaced. You get, you know, there's some who are like you who are actually very friendly and take you as you are, and there's some who just want to hate you. that's no lie. I remember it.
Well, you're a brave man going to that room. Hey, first of all, how are you? Yeah, you've recently had a scooter accident.
Oh, well, that has been that doesn't mean ideal. So I'll show you. I mean, obviously, that there's a big scar there on my left wrist. And yeah, it wasn't ideal. Basically,
what happened? This was a daytime accident, so you no alcohol involved or anything.
No, which is a scurrilous accusation that many people have leveled as if they know me or something. No, I was actually, it was very earnest. I was going between meetings. And in my defense, you know, like, so I'm 47. So, you know, reasonably middle-aged kind of a guy. But there's only three raised ways to get around our city in Auckland. You walk, and then you got hot and sweaty and you're late. You Uber or you scooter, right? So I was scootering between meetings. My cardinal sin was it was Khyber Pass, Simon Street. I had a bunch of papers in one hand, so I was kind of trying to freestyle with one hand and the other with the papers. And then I hit this dip, which, to be fair, I've gone back and looked at. It wasn't much of a dip, and I flew, man. But God, I feel really lucky. Like I farked this wrist, right? Like it was a jigsaw puzzle by the end, and the surgeon and someone were pretty impressed by what I've done. But actually, I hit my face. If you can see on its this side, that dark patch I feel deeply fortunate that I didn't get any form of brain injury. I was probably a bit concussed, but I still know I'm in a room with you and your name's Dom, and you know, but truthfully, like, a lot of people are having scooter accidents, and the surgeon was saying a lot of what I had, but a lot of head stuff as well. So, like, I don't want to say I feel like it happened for a reason, but it did literally and metaphorically shake me up and make me think, I'm glad I'm alive. I'm not that I wasn't not glad, but I'm glad I've got kids. I'm glad I had a wife who still talks to me, you know? And some of these things, you know, I'm fundamentally healthy. You know, I have some money in my pocket. So I feel like, I don't want to be too, but I feel like it sort of happened for a reason. And it's been really good for me. But my wrist is still poked. So every morning and evening I do these kind of uncomfortable exercises.
Rehab.
Yeah.
And did you, because you did an Instagram post from hospital, and you mentioned the family or the couple that came to your aid. Did you ever track them down?
No, I mean, they were lovely. And I was like, because when I hit the concrete, I had a little sleep, right? And then I sort of woke up.
You were just out cold.
Like, whether it was out cold or I was just like, but I knew I couldn't get up. And then I just sort of, my eyes shut, and I kind of, and then when I sort of came to, I mean, I don't think I was out long, this wonderful Pacifica family, I mean, I think Samoan family were there, and they were helping me. They called the ambulance, which never came, by the way, but anyway, so at the end I had to ring my wife, and I was like, you're going to be really angry with me, you know, having me telling me not to go on these scooters. But I was poked, right? Like and then I sort of I wandered into the kind of the business building near us, and I got blood all over there probably for what as I lied down, and I just couldn't get back. But they waited with me. I mean, they're amazing, just like angels or something, right? Just there to help me. I don't know what I would have done without them. But I tried to get, at the time in my half kind of delirious state, I was trying to get their phone number, but they weren't having a bar of it. They kind of, but they stayed for the, you know, it was probably half an hour. and the older man was old man, his wife and his daughter, and the old man was sort of had his arm around me, and you know, it makes me sort of emotional. I haven't thought about it actually much, you know, just how kind they were, you know. And I suppose the question is, would we be that kind? I like to think I would. But I'd probably be sitting there, you know, it's been 15 minutes, I've got to go to a meeting, you know. Truthfully, like, I hate to say that, but, yeah. You know, I feel like, but they just had all the time in the world for it. And in the end, my wife came, she was angry and apoplectic, and she did take me to the A&E at the city hospital. So, yeah, they were absolute angels.
Yeah, that is fantastic, eh? That is cool. Because I was about to say, I think most people would do exactly the same thing if you saw someone in distress.
I think so.
But the reality is, it's like, yeah, you'd be looking at your watch.
I would do it. Like, you know, in my defence, having said that, I recall when we went for a walk around, not too far from actually with the scooter accident, happened at the Domain one day, and a guy, an elderly Indian man, had slipped on the sort of cobblestones or something and cut up his face quite badly, right? And he was asking us where the hospital was, right? And we thought, oh, the bugger this, we've got to take him, right? So we got him in the car and took him into the A&E and so on and looked after him. And you know, I know in the – I've passed the tested level, right? When it's happened,
yeah.
And you know, in a busy world, I think we got to make sure we do pass that little life test. Yeah,
100%. Well, I'm glad you're okay. Are you scooter shy now? Will you go on scooters? Because I know you're. I read an article a couple of years ago when you first moved to Auckland.
Totally on
scooters.
You're a
big fan.
I was spending a lot of money a week on these scooters. Right? You think I'm joking? Like a shitload of money. Because my office is up one end of Simon Street. I'm constantly having to be down to Commercial Bay to meet with corporates and all these sort of things. And it's like, how do you get down there? It's whatever it is, 20 minutes walk. It's like 6 minutes scooter. So I was using them a lot. The honest truth is yesterday, which I haven't before, but I was just, my wrist is starting to get a bit better. I've got a bit of flexibility. Yesterday I walked past a Beam, because it was a Beam. Sorry, Beam. Not your fault, my fault. It was the middle-aged dickhead on it, not the scooter. But I saw it and I thought, shit, I'd be a lot quicker if I just got on this right now. And then I saw an image of my wife and I was like, no, I'm not getting on. I promised her I won't do it again, right?
I was more scared of Natalie than the scooter.
Oh, I actually think that's true. And the other thing is, like, you know, and I'm ashamed to say this, and I didn't say it, like, the mainstream media were after me and at the time, and I wouldn't do interviews because I know I'd get pilloried for this, and rightly so, but like, I wasn't wearing a helmet, and I'm not going to wear a helmet because, you know, you're all right with your short trim, but you know, I've got lengthy hair at the moment. I don't want to get helmet hair. so look, on the basis of that, I'm not going back on one.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Fair enough. Since you brought it up, what is happening with you here? Is this like a midlife crisis?
Because I've had about seven of those, right? So it's just messing with people, right? I just love
trolling.
The fact. It is basically a form of trolling. I think it actually is because I basically, you know, so in my, you know, I've got some responsible jobs in my life, and I love the fact that, you know, I you know, tonight I've got the AGM of the Auckland Business Chamber, right? I love the fact that like 47%, that's a statistical true fact, by the way. 47% of those people at AGM will be like, what the heck is he doing with his hair? Right? You know, I love that. I love that like half are like, let him be free to have his hair. You know? And then there's this other half who are like, maybe it's a throwback from politics where you needed people talking about you. I kind of like that in my own, like not out there in the real world, but in my own little circles, it definitely creates a controversy. And I like that.
It's a talking point.
I am getting a haircut at the end of this month, by the way. It's just that, you know, we're a cost of living crisis. I go to an expensive hairdresser. You don't want to do it too often.
Yeah, but the money you're saving on scooters at the moment, though.
Correct.
Congratulations, by the way. You've, at the time we're recording this, you've just got a new job.
Yeah.
Chairperson of the NZTA.
Yes.
Wakatai.
Yes.
So have you started this job or?
Well, funny you should say. I mean, all these people who are out there think this is some sort of fancy sinecure. It's real hard work, right? So much of the weekend was taken up with going through the papers for our first board meeting. And, you know, so it's, I don't know that I would say it's going to be like massively enjoyable, but it is an amazing challenge. You know, this is an outfit that I was going to say spends, but a better word is invests, like several billion bucks for you and me every year. It controls the state highway network. It has a big influence on what local government does around their local roads and the potholes that we've been hearing about and all that stuff. So, you know, that I'm a sucker for punishment. I like to be busy and have something that's significant. And so this is, you know, one big thing like that where, you know, hopefully, and this, I know this all gets a bit grand and probably makes me sound like a wanker, but, you know, hopefully we, you know, I'll look back on that and be able to say, yeah, you know, we, over that 3-6 year period, whatever it is, you know, we did some amazing things. You know, we got on with some infrastructure that meant that, you know, people could get around, Dom could, you know, get to his, you know, mate's place quicker and safer and all of those things. So yeah, I'm very early, but
I
want to make a difference, as cheesy as that sounds. And that's always been there. And that's something that makes me, you know, drives me. I'm not someone who, and I fear, and I might admire people who can, I don't switch off easy. I, you know, I need stuff going on. Mm. Otherwise I'd probably have to think about life and family. You know, I'm joking. You know, so I like to keep my busy, just my brain distracted, and this is one heck of a distraction.
Yeah, you say you're kidding, but I feel like that was yeah. I've reflected because I did breakfast radio for like 30 years.
Yeah,
it was a very very busy job, and I feel like on reflection, I kept myself as busy as possible, so I didn't have to face my own demons in a way.
Yeah, I think
that's just me.
No, I think that's I do try. I think hopefully all of that is true. Like if we're being really honest about it, I think hopefully though, like I do try. So you know, we're recording this reasonably early in the morning. Mm. You know, I've already been up for a few hours, and I do try to. I'm a morning guy. I do try to have a bit of a period of, you know, whether some people would call it meditation, some people call it prayer, some people call it whatever, but I do try and have a period at the start of a day. You know, hopefully my children haven't woken up, and, you know, where I can be still and maybe think and not grand thoughts, but just, you know, maybe be grateful about what's, so hopefully I'm getting better at that with my long shaggy hair that's polarizing and my broken wrist and like 15 places and so on. Yeah.
The next step is going to be like beads.
I would.
Like a dude that's been to Bali for a surfing trip.
I would, accept you'd have something more to just completely take the piss off. But maybe I need them to cover that wrist scar. But I totally would. Like, I don't know if we've just, my kids and I have just been watching, like, he's another polarizing figure in Britain, like Jeremy Clarkson, you know, the car dude.
Yeah,
and his.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
You know, after Top Gear, he's got whatever his one is called. And
oh, Clarkson's Farm. It's great.
Oh, and Clarkson Farm is amazing. But he's got like 19 man beads going on. It's like, it kind of works for an older guy. Yeah. So, you know, if you see me rocking the beads once in a while.
Yeah. Hey, let's go back to that morning routine. So, yeah, we are recording this at 8 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. And I fully respect that. I know you're a busy guy, so it's early for me. But I love that. But I wanted to ask you, yeah, more about your morning routine. So, Are you a cold shower guy or anything?
I would be, but I'm probably not. I'm probably not. I was going to say Manly, but that's old-fashioned Manly enough for that. I like the idea of those ice buckets.
Yeah, ice
like
baths,
if
yeah.
I had, but ice baths, I should say. Like I feel like because I get a bit of the restless leg in the night, you know, and so I'm taking the magnesium pills for that. I feel like that should be a Mike Hosking ad. $800 magnesia. I don't remember if it was off air or on air, but you know, we were talking maybe off air about psychologists and stuff. I've never been to psychologists, and you know, kudos to those who do and you know, get help from it. But I have a little bit over my, I suppose, life, probably more funnily enough, post parliament. I needed it in parliament, but post parliament had, you know, the odd business coach or kind of people in. And a great one that, you know, I've done a bit with, you know, she talks about how we kind of really only have 2 or 3 intense hours of power, right, a day. We think we're amazing for like 12 hours and we can do all of these things and so on. You don't. And for me, I try and have that in the morning, you know. So hopefully that's not just doing what I do for the rest of the day, which is replying to 109 emails or, you know, it's something that's focused and sort of and maybe, you know, this word means different, maybe a bit spiritual, you know. So so there's that, you know, getting up. Sometimes it's I don't want to sound like a hero, like I'd need my sleep, and I think most people do, but I don't go to bed too late. It might be 5 some days. Sometimes if I've got a lot on, it might be earlier. Sometimes a bit later, you know, it can be 6. Get up. I've got a comfy little kind of to call it a library would be, you know, way too grand, but like little book area with a nice comfy chair that's got all these phallic fruit on it that Natalie must have bought somewhere in a market or something. And I'll sit in that. I might read a bit. You know, I might think a bit. I'll have a coffee. And then, you know, eventually one of the kids will wake up early and put on a television and annoy me or an iPad or something, and then more of them, and then Natalie will turn up. But so that's nothing too exciting, but I think routines are good, aren't they? Like
The best.
Yeah, I think
absolutely the best.
I think, and it may be for men even more than women, but maybe all of us, I think routines are, and I think while I'm on a roll, you know, we live in a world where everyone's about multitasking. I just think one simple thing, you know, like reading a poem from somewhere, or a book you're reading about something that's got no instrumental value to you, that's really good for your soul.
Mm. Oh, I love that. Yeah, because you are religious, eh? So it's you're practicing of gratitude or whatever. Is it sort of like a religious thing? Or
I think so. I mean, I think, you know, religion's got a dirty sort of name these days. I think we live in such a material world, physical world, right? And I think in New Zealand that's, but you know, for me, you know, I am a practicing Christian. You know, I'm my church attendance isn't amazing at the moment, and but it does matter for me. I mean, it's you know, my father was a clergyman, and so you know, I think it's always sort of there, right? And you know, I know people, some have had bad experiences of that, and for some people, it's, you know, it's something entirely different, and I get that. But I think what you, in politics and actually my business life now, what you learn is we Kiwis, yeah, we're a particularly secular lot, but you know, we've got a lot of people, whether it's from India or China or other parts of Asia and so on, they come in with a lot of spiritualism, and I think we miss a bit of that in our society. And and like even this conversation, right, I'm conscious there'll be people listening right now, fuck that, turn the thing off, right? Because even the word they're not sort of into. But I think that's a poor sort of sign, actually, of society. I think for some people, I say it might just be you don't want the connotations. Maybe it's meditation. Maybe it's, you know, your yoga or whatever. But I do think those things where it's, you know, gratitude, a sense of some purpose higher than yourself, more than just yourself. I think that is important. But can I just put a disclaimer on this? Because, man, some people are saying there, this guy, does he think he's, you know, Mahatma Gandhi or something? Right? Right? Like, I get shit wrong every single day in the most catastrophic ways, right? So I just want to put that disclaimer on things.
Oh, no, but we all do. That's part of the human experience, isn't it? Fucking up time and time again.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Let's talk about the early years. So what I know about you is you were head boy at school.
Yes.
You played the drums. You're a drummer.
Yes.
What about earlier than that? Any sort of cultural links? You are the first Māori leader of a main political party.
Yeah.
But I feel like you're sort of disattached from...
Totally.
...from your Māori culture.
Oh, you know, I think...
You just know, the way you were raised.
I think my story is a very common one, right, at some levels. We all think we're special, but, you know, Māori dad, you know, white blonde mum off a dairy farm, father's family, you know, pretty dysfunctional, mum's much more sort of... you know, functional, you know, and on the Maori side of things, you know, grew up in West Auckland. Look, my father, because he grew up in Hamilton, his mother, you know, was straight off of Marae, but, you know, he learnt very, you know, clearly, in fact, from his mother, you know, you don't want anything to do with this Maori stuff. You're never going to get anywhere with that. You know, don't even, you want to try it in any way you can be a white Maori, you know, if I could put it that way. I mean, I'm just, you know, I'm not saying this right or wrong. Well, it's no, probably wrong, but how it was, right? And so we grew up with no sense of it. Look, and I think something that's quite fascinating for me today is I've come to terms with all that. And I think I have a much greater sense of my whakapapa and some of these things, but don't get me wrong, you know, tomorrow I'll have to do a mihi whakatau, you know, walking into NZTA. Look, that will be somewhat uncomfortable for me, right, because I don't speak te reo and, you know, it's not a natural position for me. But I think something I've come to terms with, particularly as leader of the National Party, I had to come to terms with, is I'd always fundamentally just thought, I'm a white guy, right? You know, I'm a white guy. You know, this is, you know,
that's how you're raised.
There's some Maori guys over there. They're good guys, you know, in my class, you know, but that's not me. I had to come to terms with the fact that, in truth, a lot of people, you know, my skin is not light. You know, there's you know, a bunch of things about me. A lot of people perceive me as Maori, right? And so, you know, I am a Maori. Or I think we started.
Whereas Willie Jackson would say you're a crap Maori.
I'm a crap, exactly. You're a, what is a plastic ticky Maori? Which, you know, so it's taken me a long time to, and it was really only as leader of the National Party that there was that spotlight, like everyone's on you, right? Because you're the alternative prime minister, and it's just the variety of views, right? Too Maori, not Maori enough. Yeah, I think a sense of some racism, in truth. Mm. I think New Zealand's from all sides, right? We like to think we're all great, but this is still a vexed thing in New Zealand, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot of judgment, and I'm guessing, I don't know, I'm probably projecting here, but did it come with some sort of like guilt and shame? Like this is just the way you were raised, but it's like, you feel like you should know more, even though
definitely
that was not your experience.
You know, and you've got the situation where, as I say, you know, a lot of, and indeed you get in the media, you know, it's like, kind of almost like too Maori. And then on the other side of, you know, as I say, you're on a marae and you do a bit of that and it's not your comfortable space because you've never been brought up with it. And, you know, as you say, it's that sort of plastic Maori, or your hope is you're not good at that, you know, but it's just like kind of, and in the end, you know, whakapapa is whakapapa. It's there. It's Ngāti Maniapoto. It's quite. But and the other thing that's complicated is we're all at a level mongrels. I mean, Willie Jackson as I am, right? You know, I mean, there's. You look at my father as Maori, Jewish. You know, a bit of, I don't know what it is, some form of British. We do know because they did the spit test and it went off to Ireland. It comes to quite amazing when you sort of see.
Oh yeah, Ancestry.com.
Yeah, it's quite amazing.
And we've all got a bit of Viking in us.
Correct. And then mum has got a bit of Viking, but fundamentally a bog standard sort of three veg English, you know. So it's kind of, that's New Zealand, isn't it?
Mm. I think so, yeah.
What are you?
Well, I did the ancestry thing. I can't remember. There's a bit of Irish in there, a bit of like 5% Viking.
Yeah.
We're all mutts, as you said.
I could see you like in Vikings, like movie or something, or running it. No, because you're trim and muscular. I could see you with your shirt off and some ancient tattoos and some axe or something, and they'd be saying, helmets! Attack!
Well, actually, speaking of that, I'll throw that back on you because somehow there is actually footage of you like running around shirtless like a Viking. You were on Xena or Young Hercules.
Yes, like, because basically
How did you end up? That was the
I just needed the money,
Ryan Gosling show.
Yeah, well, no, because what happened was, because but before Ryan, I was because you know I'm sadly a bit old, but I grew up in West Auckland. They were doing it. It was back in the heyday of Hercules, the Young Hercules, was it, and Xena, Warrior Princess, and they were filming those out deep west, Kumi or wherever it was, and I lived out there. I needed money, right? I mean, it's just like, we never had any money, right? I just think my kids need to, like, learn a bit of this, you know, and get the experience of it. So I freaking needed money, and I was working. Then these were in the terrible old National Day Party days of, you know, interest on student loans, no allowance, because my father earned like 46 grand, not 45 grand. And so, you know, I was working bars, Food Town. Anyone who's old enough will remember Food Town, which is now whatever it is. And then I got myself on some list as an extra. And what would basically happen is you'd rock, and it was, you know, it was maybe it's somewhere the early morning, so it was like 4 a.m. or something. You had to get yourself out to Rosebank Road, West Auckland. They'd put you on a van, and there'd be a bunch of young punks. And I always got cast as, because I've got great crossover appeal, of course. You know, I've got Cliff Curtis. I was always cast as like an Asian warrior or a Polynesian, background scene or something. And back in those days, don't get me wrong, it's never been amazing, but I could at some level take off my shirt. You know, we wouldn't be trying that these days. So, yeah, I remember running through the field with bombs going off and horses. I can't remember if that was – I think that was Xena. And then the other one I remember was Young Hercules, where we were doing sort of star fighting in like a coliseum or something around the main characters who were doing whatever they were doing. Kevin Zarbo?
Oh, yeah. He was Hercules.
I feel like I might be making up for Kevin Zarbo, but there were dudes. But it was that sort of era. Did I do any others? I might have done a little bit more, but they paid well. And the other thing I loved was they'd have a big frickin' table with food and
the catering truck,
Perk coffee and stuff, which I don't think back in sort of 1997 we'd ever seen before in West Auckland. It was amazing.
Yeah. And so have your parents or have you got it on a VHS or a DVD?
No,
is it anywhere?
No, I think Junos have tried to find it. So for all you know, this could be complete lies, but it is true. I mean, it's not a good enough story for me to make it up, right? You know, it's not like me sort of dating Elle Macpherson or something back in 96 or something. So no, it is true, but I don't know that there is – well, there will be footage by definition, but you'd have to watch like – 1,000 series of Xena.
To find a frame in the background.
Correct, which is still playing in Germany, I think, there's a Xena channel or something.
And then, so why law school? What attracted you to law?
Honest answer, so I had an older brother who was a lawyer, Timothy, and he'd sort of, and he'd done well because he got into Russell McVeigh, which... was the big best firm at that time, and my father was, you know, deeply conflicted guy. He wasn't sure whether he was about God or money, and he was really into the idea of us being successful. I think because he came from nothing, and he was sitting there as a poor clergyman earning about $9 a year, you know, with six kids, and so he was very ambitious for us. He saw my older brother, Timothy, doing well in law. He had a fancy job. And I think by that stage, he was in the UK at a big firm. And so he just really wanted me to be a lawyer. And he fundamentally pressured/bullied me into doing law. I'm glad I did. I think if I hadn't, I would have, I definitely would have gone to university. I mean, I was pretty academic, and I would have done politics. I did do a BA in politics as well as my law degrees, but I probably would have kept going and done a PhD in Marxism or something and be a left-wing sort of lecturer at Auckland University or AUT or something these days, right? So the law was good because it's a real vocation. I was good at it. You know, I got better at time. And so I'm actually glad my dad bullied me, in quotes, into law. And it did suit my disposition, right? I at school, I was a nerd who was into debating and, you know, argument, and I was always into politics, you know, which was not a family thing. That was just a weird Simonism that was sort of there, you know. And so law suited that in a way. And no, I enjoyed, you know, I was practiced for 8 years, 7, 8 years. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and it was a very successful. So you went to the UK to do some extra study. Is that, is that where you met Natalie?
Yeah, I met Natalie. And, you know, I always tell the stories. It's a bit sort of hackneyed, but it's, you know, it's a goodie. You know, we were – so she was young, you know, a Pomegul, actually Welsh, Polish, but and from the Midlands, and she was there at our college. You know, these things are like in Harry Potter style colleges, you know, and they've got the big quad in the middle, and there was a cubby hole sort of set of areas, and we walked in and we kind of brushed past each other. It was all very kind of, and we were in the same, we were in the middle common room, which is like where you, if you're doing a master's, right? We both, she was doing a master in English literature, and I was doing a master's in law, and you know, true story, she sort of said, you know, we then went out for Singapore noodles or something a week or two after that. But she then said, so she went home and rang her mum and said, you know, you won't believe it, I've met the man in my dreams. By the way, I was thinner and younger back then, okay? She said, he's this really handsome Japanese guy. So
did you go. Did you feel the same way? Like, was it an instance of attraction?
Yeah, I think it was, because I think, and the other thing was, in our middle common room, like, they were quite boozy. You sort of, like, Friday nights, I mean people, it's a caricature, right? You literally get dressed up in, I think they call it a subfusc, but, you know, it's a tux, right? You have to wear a tux to these things, and it's really subsidized by the college. You slap down, like, £5, and it's kind of all you can eat and drink all night, right? And it's courses, and you're finishing with fruit platters and sherries, and it's outstanding, right? And by the end, you're trolleyed, and you wake up on Saturday morning, hangover, and you're at long tables and all this. So we're there at this group. And she and I were the only, if you want to put it this way, kind of English as a first language kind of Anglos, right? Or sort of, you know, because everyone else was from Italy and Greece and Brazil and, you know, Russia, and it was a real United Nations. So I think we were kind of forced together because we were the only two. I can remember one of the Greek guys, you know, great guy. Like, he's probably a high court judge or something in Greece right now, doing incredibly, like, he's a genius, very urbane and sophisticated. But, you know, after a few drinks, I remember once I made a joke about his mother, right? Like, I don't know his mother, right? It was just a joke. And, like, everything changed, right? And I thought, uh-oh, I'm about to die here. Like, and all the kind of people from that culture, you know, whereas Natalie and I were the only ones who were not from that kind of world. So we were kind of, forced together, peas in a pod. We started going out. And, I knew it's cheesy as it sounds. I knew within, like, a fortnight we were going to be together. I just felt like that was the thing. But it was pressured because I had a year of this master's degree. And then I was coming back to the UK, New Zealand, I should say, because I was bonded to my law firm. They'd given me a shitload of money to help with this incredibly expensive year out in UK on a high pound at that point in time. So I had to go back. So I was kind of like, well, you know, you're either coming with me, love, or you're not, but we've got to make a decision really soon, because if you're not, you know, there's no point wasting another 9 months on this. So I was pretty hardcore. And but so we got serious very quickly. Yeah, is the
out of necessity.
Yeah, I don't know. I suppose. And then she was back at Mount Maunganui, where I was a young criminal lawyer. It was they were good years.
So you were a Crown prosecutor in Tauranga for a while. Were you ever a defence lawyer?
I did a couple of defence cases as a young commercial lawyer in Auckland, you know, where effectively Rich Daddy had a son in trouble. I mean, I don't know what the freak I was doing back then. That was before I'd been a prosecutor. But I can remember one guy had done like 160Ks up Parnell Rise, young punk, whose dad was really wealthy. I did what they call a plea and mitigation for him at the sentencing. I remember sort of mumbling something about him being a good kid from a good family. He won't do it again. I think he got a massive fine or something. I can remember other EBA, you know, excess breath alcohol. So I think I did a couple of things in defence, but fundamentally all my law career was Crown prosecution work. So that's the, you know, the police do the more, the less serious stuff, and the Crown prosecutors come in for anything that can go to jury trial. So I was a jury trial lawyer effectively for, look, 6.5-7 years, and I worked really hard, but it was very satisfying work. You know, serious stuff, the real, you know, rape, murder, serious fraud, a lot of drugs. Not me personally, this is the trials, you understand.
Did you end up with any sort of like PTSD or anything?
Yeah,
like,
I did.
You must see some grim things. Like, I'm thinking of you know, the photograph totally. Evidence books that you're privy to, and the judge Definitely. And the jury.
Like, oh, I can remember. I mean, I won't describe them because it's but I can remember some really heinous stuff. And I think, you know, I feel bad now looking back. I probably would have handed it more, but as a really young guy, and probably you're not allowed to do this, but I would show them to Natalie and practice my openings and closings and cross examinations on her. Right at, you know, a theme of the podcast at 4 a.m. or something before I did it at sort of 10 a.m. that day, and. Like, in a funny sort of way, more trauma from law than politics. You know, as much as politics has got its – and don't get me wrong, there's a bit of trauma from politics too. But, like, I think what happened at the end of that – because I was a young guy, the end of my legal career, I remember when I got out, because I'd become the candidate for Tauranga and I was going to try and go to Parliament and take that leap of faith, really. Like, it was a weight off my shoulders, right? Because – I was doing jury trials. I was like a workhorse for this law firm I was in. I was every day I was in a jury trial, right? And the next one would start the next day and I'd be preparing all night. But I wanted that because I wanted to get the experience, right? And, you know, many, many jury trials. What happens is you become very cynical, very dark if you're not careful, and you start thinking everyone's a freaking criminal. So you go to the supermarket and you see some guy picking up some big bottles of water or something. You're like, oh, he's about to do a big cook of methamphetamine. You know, that's or, you know, wow. Or you see some – you become very
– you see the worst in people?
You absolutely see the worst in people because I became my specialty, if you like, my last sort of, say, 3 or 4 years were – and again, I, you know, treat this sensitively. I know for some people it's even talking about it at general levels, disturbing sexual cases, right? And you know, there's big problems in society, and just seeing those things around young people and so on, you have to cope in some way. And I was probably a bit young and a bit kind, and I was ambitious, and I wanted to, I didn't realise at the time it was affecting me, but when I stopped and the weight came off my shoulders, I realised how much actually I was in a, I don't want to say a dark place, that's too dramatic, but it was definitely, I was more cynical, dark, and I everyone I met was like, I'd be looking at you saying, oh yeah, that guy, he's, you know, that's what you become if you're not careful.
And how do you do a job like that and not take your work home? Like say you're dealing with someone and they get found not guilty and you know they're guilty.
Yeah.
Then how do you deal with the complainant?
Well, I didn't. You know, I did take it home. I think that was a problem. And you know, and that's always been, you know, an issue for me. I probably wear these things too passionately and on my sleeve. So, you know, that was a real and what it meant as well in the criminal law, but if you're a prosecutor, it's different if you're defence, you have an obligation to try and get your guy or girl off and you know, force the Crown to really prove it properly. But if you're a Crown prosecutor, you're meant to be what they call a minister of justice and quite dispassionate. You know, you're not meant to be overly zealous in trying to get the prosecution. You know, it's the old thing, you know, it's better to have sort of 10 guilty men go free than one innocent convicted.
Yeah, there was a quote from the famous Greek king.
Yeah, well, that's right. And so that's the thinking. So, but I would go pretty hard, right? I got myself in trouble a time or two in the Court of Appeal, right, for being overly zealous, for pushing too hard. But, you know, that was my way, you know, I probably did, if I'm fair, I probably did start thinking, oh, they're all guilty, you know, which is a bit of a trick, right? They're not all, I think what's true in our system is they tend to all be factually guilty of something, if you know what I mean, like, but actually the Crown's obligation is to prove that charge on that day in relation to that person. And just because someone's a bad guy doesn't mean they have committed that crime beyond reasonable doubt. So yeah, it is look, I think now I'm finally in a place where I still like to be busy, but I'm finally in a place where I'm not working weekends. I'm enjoying it. As a generalization, I did this last weekend because I've got my first board meeting this week. But as a generalization,
you got good balance.
Smelling the flowers, much more balanced. Now, that wouldn't be balanced, I think, in probably a normal person's world. But in my world, it's more balanced than it's been in a very long time.
So did you always have those political aspirations? Was that always a plan for a young Simon? Were you like, I'm going to do law for a few years then?
Yeah, it was. I think it was. I mean, you know, weirdo as that makes me, I think, well, I sort of explain it. Some people are deeply, you know, you take a, not that I'm remotely comparing myself to say, but, you know, you take a Peter Burling, he's into yachting, you know, you would have got behind the mic and went, people have their different, I was a reader, you know, I mean, I had, you know, brothers who were more sporty than me, perhaps into other things, but I'm quite young. Actually, my auntie who lived in America, she bought us a kid's series of books on US presidents. I mean, it was slightly better than it sounds. And I would read those, and I don't know, it was just like a spark there, right? I was like, this is about the world and what makes it go round. And I could see that politics really mattered. So I was a real anorak. I got into it very young. As I say, very, very young, I joined the National Party. There was no history of that in my family. I tell the story, like, I don't even know if it's true anymore, but I've told it so many times, it kind of must be that it was Food Town, actually, Te Aratu North. I saw these guys putting up a sign, I think, for the 93 election, or pre sort of stuff that. I saw them doing that, and I'd been thinking about that, yeah, I want to be part of the National Party, right? And so I sort of went up to them, and then suck of a punishment, I ended up delivering all of the guys' leaflets probably for the next election.
You were young, like 17, 18.
16. You know, and so no, I did get into it, but I think it was that debating, it was that ideas, the same things I liked about law, you know, prosecuting a case, if you like, and so... Yeah, it's, and I got no regrets, you know, it's a brutal life, and I would not remotely lightly go back to it, but what politics always is very interesting. You know, there's never a dull moment. And what I do miss today is there's a lot I love about not being in it. But the adrenaline is addictive.
Yeah, the rush of it.
I mean, yeah. If you are always, you know, if I was there in government right now, you're always in demand, you know, and that becomes very addictive. Your phone is always going, whereas now I might have one text message waiting, if that, you know. I know if I was still a senior politician, I'd have like 200, you know. They are just always, and that's every bit, not that I've ever taken methamphetamine, but that's every bit like an illicit drug, I imagine.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. Is that what someone like Winston Peters, who's old now, but he's still vital and still vibrant, yeah, and still doing it? Do you think that's it? He's just had like a lifetime of this high cortisol level, this sort of rush of being important or being busy
or
being in
demand. Something in that, and I wouldn't dismiss that. I'm not so sort of. I wouldn't make that entirely negative, right? You know, like, because
absolutely
it is about
not
a life that's. But and I think a guy like him, you know. I think what's also true is, for all the stories about Winston, and we won't get into them because I'll get myself in trouble
and
politicise this, but I think for all the – what is also true is this is a guy who I think has a very good diet. You
does
know,
he?
Yeah, actually. And
doesn't he love his – he still smokes his ciggies, doesn't he?
No comment. But you know, but look, he, you know, the fish and the salads and right, so on. So I think, you know, I wouldn't overplay it. You know, in comparison, I'm trying to be diplomatic here, but let me say this. If we look at the US presidential race, where you got a couple of older gentlemen, one of whom, you know, the stories are, has got his, you know, acuity issues. I'm pointing to my head.
Oh, Biden, yeah.
Winston's not actually in that category. You know, this is a guy who's still very much with it and at the, you know, near the top of his game.
Yeah. Well, there's a comedian I really like, and he made a joke about Biden. He said, Biden could be the first president we have that could be assassinated by a punch to the gut. But they're about the same age, right? Biden and Trump. They're
correct.
Similar age. And Trump seems so much more vibrant and so much more lively.
Correct. I mean, you've got to hand it. Whatever you think about Trump, and I know there'll be people who have a lot of thoughts about him, and, you know, on a bad day, he scares me too. you know, in his positions on sort of Russia and some of these things. But you're right. I think he's 78. I mean, good grief. He's actually, for a guy who supposedly eats a lot of McDonald's and Coca-Cola, Coke, yeah. but I don't think drinks. Maybe he does. I don't know. You know, he's pretty vibrant. You're right. The way he gets up and gives those speeches and... You know, and he must, he looks like, I would be fascinated to meet him because he looks like a big guy.
A giant, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you get into politics, you get into the National Party, and then there's this weekly TV interview thing with you and Jacinda Ardern.
Yeah.
And you're like, you're called the young guns or whatever.
Yeah.
So you're just, you're young, attractive, just sort of, I suppose, bringing a bit of vibrancy into a fairly yes. dull sort of environment. Yeah, what are your recollections of that time?
Oh, definitely. I had two lucky breaks, if you want to. I mean, you make your own luck at a level, and, you know, but a couple of things that went very well for me early on in my career. The first was beating Winston. We actually even just talked about him in Tauranga. And that was, you know, that was a time of, that was a phase thing. He was caught up in a bunch of issues, and I was able to just, as a young guy, glide past him. Tauranga was ready for change. But we were in a good campaign and, you know, won well. That was great because there was huge spotlight on that campaign and that election on the television and so on. And then the other one was getting young guns. I think John Key put me forward for that. And remember, you know, it's so different than today, and not to be entirely mean about our TV, but we were talking about it off air, you know, as we talk about this, you know, News Hub's about to be gone, TVNZ's got its very real issues, this was still the heyday, just, it was Paul Henry, you know, at its absolute height, everyone, like everyone watched this show, right? It was unbelievable. You know, like, it's like now if you were on, say, TVNZ Breakfast, you know, a lot of people wouldn't even necessarily kind of know. Or
no, so fragmented.
But everyone was watching this thing. And so there you had, yeah, I think you're right. Dare I say it, you know, people can make their judgment about who was more attractive, but probably not me. But you know, you had me and Jacinda and every week. And we took it seriously, man. Like, she would sledge me before we went on air, you know. We got on very well, right? We had a lot of fun. And Paul Henry brought the best out of us. You know, he's a very clever, you know, fun interview who loved politics, and he himself was a National Party candidate, you know, back in the ether. So it was heyday stuff. It really made me, and it got me good. Like, it's, you know, it's the old 1,000 hours or whatever. I mean, some people say, well, you're never good, mate. But, like, every week, prime time, difficult topics, had to be on brief. I knew if I got a word or two wrong, John Key would ring me and tell me off, you know. Not that you sort of did that. You know what I mean? Like, it was, we were conveying that, and I wasn't there for myself, you know, I was obviously trying to build my own brand, but I was also there for the National Party, which was in government, to kind of make sure we were dominating the Labour Party, and we were putting forward the best positions for us in it. So that was like my big thing, but because it went well, if it had gone badly, it would have been differently, but because it went well, you know, I was very fortunate. Like, I became a minister quickly, I then became a cabinet minister, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I worked my ring off, but, you know, I scaled to the top, or close to the top, and, you know, by the end of that time in government, I think it was number 4 or 5 in government. So, you know, that was a, and I remember when I went, I thought, shit, if I just become a select committee chair, which is lower down the scale, you know, that'd be pretty cool, you know. Member of Parliament, select committee. In the end, I did much better than that. So I feel very fortunate.
You didn't have, like, I sort of imagine you being like a head boy at school, having aspirations to one day being Prime Minister.
Look, I think you get that after a time, right? But I think, you know, I suppose I'm a funny mix, aren't we all, you know, of confident and not confident, you know, and I think that's a...
You have moments here.
Yeah, some of that's a Maori thing as well, you know, it's just, you know, a bit bashful or, you know, be careful.
You're supposed to be humble, aren't you?
Yeah, no, I know that wouldn't be a lot of people's perception of me necessarily, but, you know, so I feel very... grateful at the career trajectory in those early years, lucky breaks, some hard work as well, and you know, it went very well.
Yeah, that's interesting. Interesting little insight before that line about John Key, how he'd watch you on TV and then call you up or whatever. Because he was a very, very successful leader. And,
totally.
And you were part of his cabinet at a phenomenal time for totally. This party in particular. Did he tear you a new one from time to time?
Not often. But I think the thing with John is he didn't need to. You knew if he was not.
Really?
Pleased. Oh, yeah, totally. You know, look, this is a guy who's, you know, a trader, very successful guy, you know, hugely likable guy. I haven't seen a lot of him lately, but actually I saw him last week. And, you know, you just can't help. Half an hour with John, you just love the guy, right? Whatever you thought the 5 minutes before, you sort of say, he's a very personable people person. He is what you see. But you knew when he wasn't happy. That didn't happen often, but I can remember one or two times. You know, where perhaps I'd got something not quite right, and you knew.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Was it, you knew because...
In the eyes. I think it was in the eyes. Oh,
so he didn't... it's not what he said, but what he didn't say?
Yeah, I think it's in the eyes. And just, just the tone, oh my you know? Because that wasn't normal, easy-ozy, happy-go-lucky John, right? Of course, he was much more than that. I don't say that dismissively, but he gave that demeanour. So when that wasn't the demeanour, you knew.
So, yeah, you knew you fucked up.
Correct.
Oh, there was even, when you were doing this Young Gun stuff, so you were married to Natalie. I think this Jacinta was probably single at the time. This is pre-Clark. But there's even rumours that you guys, this is your on-screen chemistry, but there were rumours that you guys were seeing each other.
Paul Henry would sort of spruik that, you know, say, the chemistry is electric and all these things. You know, I don't know. But we got on very well. There's a lot I like about Jacinta. You know, obviously, I disagree with a lot that she would believe and you know, some of the ways she handled, you know, the last 3 or 4 years of her prime ministership. But, you know, as a person, liked her a lot. I admire the way she, actually carried things very lightly in a way I probably didn't or don't. You know, if I've got an issue, I'll stress about it and work too hard on the thing about it. So I think she you know, came at things at face value quite lightly. And so in some regards, while, you know, people have, and, you know, I think in my view, rightly so, will point to some weaknesses in her leadership style, some big strengths. Mm. And, yeah, we got on very well. We did have a laugh. And you know, we were kind of this sort of, in quotes, celebrity couple at the time, albeit, you know, not in any real sense, I stress.
Yeah, that's it. Did you ever sort of, I mean, it was a crazy turn of events that saw her quickly rise and then become Prime Minister, and a very successful Prime Minister for a time at that.
Yep.
Did you ever foresee that?
I must admit, others did. I didn't. Maybe it's the old familiarity breeds, not contempt, but a kind of a complacency. And I felt she was too, what I've just said, relaxed, if you like, you know, for that kind of grinding prime ministerial role that you've seen from a Helen Clark or a John Key, where it's every aspect of your life, because in a level it has to be. So she was a very different style of politician and prime minister, I think. And of course, you know, first ever, I think, you know, young mum as prime minister, which is a remarkable thing.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about, I've got a list here of some of the low, sort of great,
so many
greatest hits, yeah, great, and greatest shits.
Yeah.
So there were some, I was just Googling you the other day doing some research and,
I mean, how many items are there? It must be like 10 trillion items.
There's a lot. So there's, some secret tapes where there's a lady called Maureen Pugh and you were caught on tape calling her fucking useless.
Yes.
I don't know the backstory about that, but I mainly want to know like what happens afterwards. Like, first of all, it's a secret tape. So that's the ship form. When that comes out, like, do you have to phone Maureen and grovel?
Yeah, something like that. I mean, I think, you know, so many things. I think...
Like, it's awful. Like, we've all talked about it.
Firstly, at one level, you can say, you know, well, we've all said ridiculous things, but we're not all getting secretly taped, right? That's explaining away. I think what's true, though, is, you know, all of that said, you know, here was me on a colleague saying things I shouldn't have, and I deeply regret that. I think, you know, if you take that period, you know, what was amazing to me, and I'm going to be a bit self-serving here, but hey, you know, it's my version of history, so I'm going
sure.
to. Probably that's like one of the very exceptional ones that I do regret. Fundamentally, in what was a topsy-turvy, very controversial time when the National Party was eating itself and going through deep upheaval, I don't look back with really much regret at all. I feel like at the time, with the facts I had, I acted with integrity and well. And not everyone would have seen that from the outside because it looks like a... But I believe I exhibited... I'm going to say this was not modest in New Zealand terms, but if I was an American, I'd say it. Donald Trump would certainly say, I believe I exhibited great leadership through that period, right? Mm. And I kept and actually, we kept momentum, and I kept the National Party in the mid-40s through that period, which, you know, is a remarkable feat. And that was, it was team, but, you know, we had policy momentum. We were doing a lot of work behind the scenes that at a level set up what has happened, you know, a government now with policy and work. So, you know, I'm philosophical. I kind of say, you know, I think it was, you know, and he's not a politician you'd hear quoted very often, but I think it was Richard Nixon at his impeachment or when he had resigned from being president after Watergate. But, you know, you kind of don't know the highs if you haven't hit the lows, you know. If you haven't hit the valleys, the highs aren't as high. So I don't look back with regrets. I kind of embrace all of what happened. It was a roller coaster. And I don't think, you know, if I think about my conduct, it'd be one thing if I thought, you know, you got a bunch of things wrong, but I think if people now look back a bit more sort of soberly, objectively, you know, I say we, the likes of myself and Paula Bennett and my leadership team, I think we handled things well fundamentally. What's remarkable, and the media was after me every single day for about 2 years, as I held on as long as I did, actually. And really it was in the end COVID that sort of got me.
Yeah.
Not the 15 scandals within the National Party.
Well, the scandals are all fairly minor on the big scheme of things, aren't they? So Winston Peters, you had an interesting relationship with him. There's some clips online that I found where like he mocks you for your Kiwi accent.
Totally.
And how you say China. He's like, I don't know where this place Torna is.
Yeah.
Which is like schoolyard bullying, really, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I think you know,
is that water off a duck's back to you? Is that embarrassing at the time? Are you humiliated?
I mean, look, when I reflect on it, it's a bit like, at the time, no, it's not embarrassing. But I think, you know, you think back and think, oh, look, I did think the overall, and it wasn't so much Winston, actually, but, you know, some of the media aspect on that, I think, was a bit classist and possibly racist. I'll be able to say that. You know, I do think they would have treated others differently. And you know, the media's a pack, right? And they go through phases. And, you know, if they're not, you know, the Labor Party will have a bit of this going on, the Green Party right now, where the media's recalibrating, they've got a new government, they'll be pretty hard on them, right? And that was the phase they were in the National. So that's sort of that. So, you know, I'd be lying, I've said those things don't affect you. In the end, they do. And there were hard days, it's hard to get up, right? But, you know, I did, and we kept... We kept moving, but oh look, now I'm philosophical. But yeah, at the time, some of the stuff was hard.
Yeah, like there was a slushy thing as well. Like where, so I think the Labor Party under Jacinda Ardern, was it Kelvin Davis, the corrections minister? He bought like 100 slushy machines for prison guards to have in the office. And for some reason, like you saying it was a waste of taxpayers' money, it became like a big meme thing.
Yeah, it did.
Was that because of the way you say slushy?
Well, the irony, I suppose the lesson there is there's a difference between what works in Parliament and what works in social media, right? Parliament has lost a lot of its verve, right? It used to be a rough, tough, rambunctious place, and I like that. But it's not well-suited for the clip things up, you know, where things can be taken out of context. What had happened there was, yeah, we had the government on the ropes, actually. And I did a 5 minute speech. You get sort of time limits, and then I moved to get another 5 minutes. I got another 5 minutes, which was unexpected. And you know, I'm yelling slushies now. In the heat of the moment, in that parliament, it worked, right? But when you replay it as a meme, like a million times, to young punks who are 17 who've got no freaking idea of what Parliament is, let alone anything else. It doesn't work, right? But, you know, shit happens.
Yeah. I don't know why it was so funny, but it just was. And what about Todd Muller? So he was the leader that it's very Game of Thrones, isn't it, Parliament? It's not for
it
the
was
faint.
In that period. I think, you know, what in government it can be quite like a military, you know, you're marching forward to get the key sort of English government, you know, it's all, everyone knows their place, you know, it's very hierarchical. What happens though after like that 9 years of that is there's like a pressure valve that needs to be let off and the craziness comes, right? And as you say, Game of Thrones. I mean, it was Game of Thrones without the killing. I'm not aware of any killing, right? So, you know, it just was, right? And so, again, I'm not judgmental. You know, we got to a point, as I say, I'm surprised in a way I didn't get done earlier. But COVID came. I knew at that point I was in a pickle, right? I could either speak out about COVID and kind of go nuts on it and some of the issues there, that wasn't going to go so well, or I could be quiet. But if you go quiet, you lose momentum and you go down in the polls anyway. And I knew there was a number in the polls. If I went under it, in terms of my party's support, they were going to move, right? These guys were on routine, you know, for years looking for any reason. Because, you know, Parliament's a place full of ambitious people, and rightly so. But that time came. You know, I wasn't going to go down without a fight. We put it to vote. You know, the rumour has it, who knows, I lost by one vote. You know, that was that. Maybe, who knows, maybe in a life sense, it was all doing me a favour. You know, because life's pretty good now.
Yeah, everything happens for a reason. But, I can't imagine that time would have been very nice. So, yeah, you were replaced by Todd Muller. He made a very, very good opening speech, I thought. Seemed very prime ministerial.
Yep.
And then how many days later? How many days did he last?
It's a 50-something.
Because
it's tough, right?
Yeah.
It's all that stuff. And that's why I say, you know, pat on the back to me. You know, I was going through that for years, right? Yeah. At that period, very, very hard. And you say it's tough. Look, it was. But the tougher bits when you're in it, actually, it's a bit like that when I told you I got out of criminal law to go into politics. That moment when you're no longer leader of a party that's got a lot of division at that time and issues, the weight comes off your back again. Life is good. Like, as long as internally within yourself, you're not sitting there thinking, I've done these things wrong. And I genuinely, you know, maybe it's what I just have to tell myself, but I think personally, genuinely, I don't sit there with a lot of regret that I got things wrong, as I've already said. So actually, you know, it was a hard day. I had to go out and give a kind of a eat humble pie speech. And you know, and the irony of these things is as the media always do, because they're out to get you every single time. Once they've got you, they're your friend again, right? And they're like, if only he had given that speech when he was leader. It's like, well, I did, but you guys never covered it.
Yeah,
you know, that's the way it goes.
They're like a pack of vultures. Yeah. They're scavengers that want blood.
But the next day, life is good, right? And, felt very, very good. A plea would be to, you know, those out there who actually don't follow the stuff that closely, because I think those who do have a bit more of an understanding, you know, don't go up to David Seymour or Winston Peters or Nicola Willis or Chris Hipkins or, you know, James Shaw, Marima Davidson, and, you know, swear at them and tell them what assholes they are. Look, that's, you don't really know. They're all there trying to do their thing, and you'll have a snippet of something. And so those ones would get me. You know, you sit down on a plane and some guy's in your face abusing you for an hour, you know.
It's actually
just like, oh, totally, you know. And it's just kind of like, so, you know, for all of the people think, you know, oh, that politician's a hothead or that, you know, being a good politician at a senior level requires a lot of self-control.
That's quite astonishing. That's astonishing to me. Because people are always nice in person. Like, there's that phrase, keyboard warriors. But there does seem to be a thing with politicians where it's like
a free pass.
It's fair game.
That's right.
It shouldn't be.
But hey, look, all of this sounds, it was a great ride.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of privilege that comes being in politics. And, you know, you get to meet amazing people, do some really interesting things. So, yeah.
What about Christopher Luxon? You worked with him for a while.
Yeah.
What did you make of him?
I look, he's, you know, a very personable, good guy. And, you know, he you know, I think what's going to happen with this government, it's, you know, I'll be a bit careful because now I'm a public servant at a level in the CNCTA chair role, and I, you know, and I think the code means I have to sound like I could work comfortably with either part of the parliament and all of that. And that's all true, by the way. You know, I have a regard for Chris Hipkins and some of his colleagues. But, you know, I think he's a good guy, Chris Luxon. I think he's doing a good job. And I think, you know, it's a new government. It's going to pick up momentum. I think that's inevitably what happens with governments. What happened with the Ardern government, you know, the Key government, the Clark government, and what happened with this one too.
Mm. And what about... So the gay marriage vote, you voted against that. You look, was that like because of your religious beliefs, or you look back now and I think vote differently now?
I would vote differently now because so you get hung up on these ridiculous things that, you know, don't matter, and well, they do matter, but you know, your kind of technical arguments about them don't matter. So, you know, I'm clear I would change that now. I mean, I think in the end, it wasn't, you know, out of some sort of, you know, someone cast a bigotry or silly business like that. You know, I had my technical reasons why I thought, you know, I thought we were in a better place at that time not to support that law. But, you know, in the end, I was wrong. I was missing a big picture. It was all trees without the forest, you know, and that is sort of that, yeah.
Is it quite liberating for you to admit that, or is it quite hard? Does it feel like eating some humble pie?
It doesn't feel like humble pie. I think the issue with these, you know, social issues like that is they become very binary, right? You know, well, we voted that way, must be a homophobe. And you know and have a position on the LGBT community, you know. So this is the, I think that's and people then, you know, they'll typecast you, right? Well, that guy's just a religious nut who has that view. I don't think that's fair. In my case, maybe in some people's case, you know, as I say, there were some nuanced technical reasons, but you know, I missed the wood for the trees, and I regret that.
Well, I feel like Luxon had the same sort of thing. Like people were like, he's a fundamentalist Christian, he's going to ban abortion. Yeah. It was like there's almost the scaremongering and fear tactics in a way. So yeah, what was the COVID stuff? So this is when you were still leader of the National Party. Yeah. You got death threats at the time.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I can remember.
What did you say or do?
Being notified those. Look, in the end, if you go back and look at the various sort of statements, they were, by today's standard, very moderate, right? You know, I wasn't running the crazy conspiracy theories. I wasn't, you know, we were making, again, quite technical arguments around, you know, in fact, I pushed for the lockdown. It wouldn't have happened as fast as it did if I hadn't pushed Jacinda Ardern and her government into it, both privately and publicly, right? But then there was a point where the social costs and the overall costs of the thing were worse than the outcome was trying to get, right? And I was making that case. But I think what I learned then is you can be right too early. The crowd hasn't caught up with you, right?
Yeah.
And actually, you know, if you look at Chris Hipkins right now, he's getting some flack, you know, that he should be saying and jumping around more. Actually, in those early days of opposition, I don't think that's fair at all, right? Mm. You're better to sit there and let the government play its role, sort of tactically speaking, let them do that. But that wasn't my style. I was out there, I was pushing for it. And yeah, death threats, look, they're scary. They're really, the thing about these things, it's not so much me and how it affects me, it's how it affects your family, right? And admittedly, what happened then is we, you know, our house at the time in Tauranga, Parliamentary Service, ended up fitting it with more panic alarms than you've had hot dinners and fences and da-da-da-da. And, you know, my father-in-law, who was with us for lockdown from the UK because he got trapped here, you know, every so often he'd go to turn on the lights down where he was sort of living in a kind of a granny flat type area and press the panic alarm and there'd be police there in 3 minutes. And it was good to know they came. I'd never seen guys scale a wall so fast, right? But it was scary, and I do think, you know, I think a little bit of a tendency in New Zealand, people say, you know, it's the centre-left politicians who have all this hard stuff happen. Actually, no, I think it happens across the spectrum. And, you know, I'm sure that the Chris Lux and the David Seymours and so on are living with these things, even though they don't talk about them much or if at all.
Mm. How old were your kids at the time?
They
were
a bit younger, young, right? So they're just 12, 10, 16. So we're talking, you know, sort of, I don't know, 9, 8, 6, 3 sort of things.
Okay, you know, but so how do you explain that to them?
We'd be pretty sheltered.
Right.
But what is true, and I'm not so too, we're talking about my children per se, but I think what is also true, and see, who was I talking to? Someone in public life, you know, who wasn't a politician, sports, actually very significant, I won't say who, sports star. And, you know, again, what would affect me was not what happened to me. I could take the abuse. I got crocodile skin in the end. And the issue becomes you end up being too insensitive, right, to what people are saying, which sometimes is valid criticism. But it's how it affects your family. Kids go to school. They get bullying at school, right? You know, it only takes two in a class. And they're having you on because your dad is blah or your mum is, you know, duh. And that's the stuff that really, you know, affects you. How your kids are. When they're too young, do I understand they haven't done anything wrong? But I think that happens across various forms of public life.
Yeah, but yeah. It shouldn't. And you, what you were saying before that about you having like a crocodile skin, you shouldn't have to.
No.
You know what I mean? It doesn't make it right. We shouldn't be condoning that at all.
No, it's a tricky one, isn't it? It's, yeah. I always think, you've got to be careful to, when someone's abusing the crap out of you, you know, there'll be something in it where they've got a point potentially, right? and you just, you want to, you know, you want to, if there is a valid point, you want to sort of hear that.
Yeah. So when you're a leader of the opposition and you're doing tough interviews, like say, like Mike Hosking on ZB, yeah, or John Campbell had Campbell Live at the time, Jack Tame perhaps on, yes, Q&A or Sunday, whatever it is, do you get nervous before them? How much prep's involved? Do you sit down afterwards and have like a post-analysis or debrief with your team?
I think as a cabinet minister and the opposition leader, I certainly over-prepared. You know, to me it would have been unforgivable to go into that and not technically have an answer around something and be accurate about it. And I think you look back at my record and you say, actually, that guy was strong in that. He never got his facts wrong. He always constructed the argument right. Once I lost the leadership, though, it was a bit more of a whatever kind of a phase of life. In fact, the interviews flow better when you're like that, right? It's, you know, you're a bit less prepared. You're kind of a bit more laissez-faire, kind of who cares sort of thing. And actually what you find is these things aren't necessarily as probing as you, and your demeanor matters as much or more as kind of having all the facts right. Mm. So I think by the end, I went into these things pretty easy-ozy. They're very different styles. You know, your Jack Tame one is whatever it was, 10 minutes. If it's going badly for you, 15 minutes. you know, they keep it going. You know, my look at a level, very cynically speaking, as a politician, I would look at those things and say, look, actually, the vast preponderance of Kiwis ain't watching this on a Sunday morning.
Yeah, yeah.
So actually, it's all just about style, demeanour. If they want to keep chipping in and interrupting you and, you know, with their questions and trying to cross-examine you like they're Perry Mason, let them finish their thing. Don't talk over them. Let them say whatever they want and then get back to what you want to say, right? So it's, you end up, the Mike Hosking one's more like an orgasm, right? It's like over before you've begun, right? I don't know about you, but, you know, it's like 2 minutes, right? And it's kind of, so that is very intense commercial radio. So I don't know I was particularly good at that, but you got to know what you're going to say before you're on. Like, have you got 3 points you want to get out? Because he might go anywhere. Obviously, you know.
You get a briefing, though? Like, you get a briefing of the theme of the chat? Or
not really. Oh. I mean, look at a level, it'll be like, oh, we're on to talk about crime. Or you're on to talk about, you know, Auckland City issues. You're on to talk about, you know, the tax cuts you're promising. But look, of course, anything can go. And, of course, the reason they get you on may also be something else that you don't want to talk about in addition to that thing, like, you know, a personnel issue you've got or whatever. And then, you know, and then there's everything else in between, you know, your more soft TV ones where it's like being more by a cuddly teddy or whatever, and
a pack of Labradors.
Yeah, you know. So they're all a bit different. But I think my general advice to politicians today would be sort of go on with good demeanour. You know your facts, but actually it's more how you appear that people are smelling, aren't they? You know, it's kind of that test. What's it like with the sound off? Are you sitting there smiling? If Jack wants to talk over you, hey, Hakuna Matata, my friend, it's all good.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that, because I've had Ashley Bloomfield on the podcast.
Yes.
And he talked about the Hosking thing. And on Hosking mornings, he said him and his comms team would be up at like 3 a.m. prepping for it. And, like, he'd be shitting himself and he'd wake up in a sweat those mornings before the alarm went off.
I can imagine.
And then in the lead up to the last election, Winston Peters did a train wreck of an interview with Jack Tame. Yes. And there were opinion pieces afterwards saying, oh, Winston Peters not fit for Parliament because this. And you're right. No one's watching. No one really cares. Or people that do watch, and then they make up their own.
And of course,
mind.
There's different purposes. You know, from Winston Peters' perspective, having a, in quotes, train wreck interview might be a wonderful thing, right? Because there's a segment of New Zealand who, you know, quite likes that, actually. So it's all where it's a bit different if you're a leader of one of the two bigger parties where, you know, you're seeking to be, I think you used the word before, you know, more statesmanly around or womanly around those things.
Did you sort of like Winston Peters, or you like sparring with him?
Oh, totally. Look, I mean, he is a great New Zealand character, you know, who's done a... you know, who's done so much. You know, I think I said to him relatively recently something like, you know, someone needs to write a book about you, Winston. I said, but you might need to be gone so that there's no defamation laws involved. and he said something like, you know, I've been too busy living life, not writing life. But, you know, I think whatever your view about Winston Peters, he has been a big singular figure around New Zealand politics now for a very long time, and I think right now, you know, he brings some welcome significant experience into the government. You know, everyone will have their view, but that's sort of mine.
Yeah, I agree. Like, you see your footage of him with Muldoon in the 70s. Amazing. Like, he's like the Forrest Gump of New Zealand politics. He's everywhere. Yeah. Through every sort of government over the last 50-odd years, he's been there. It's been a remarkable career. And, it's going to be a huge loss when he eventually...
There will have to be a big Winston book sometime, you know.
100%.
Like for, you know, New Zealand politics. Look, as I say, they'll have to make sure they've got a good defamation lawyer. But
you'll wait till he dies. It's the only safe time to do it. Yeah. There was another clip I found on YouTube of you getting kicked out of Parliament by Trevor Mallett, who's the Speaker of the House.
Yeah.
Is that a moment of shame? Is it like an All Black getting a red card?
I think it's a moment of pride.
Oh, yeah.
By the end, you know, it's I think it depends who you are, right? There'll be some cats in that Parliament who, like, oh no, I've been kicked out of Parliament. My mother saw this. What am I going to do? You know, but you know, I think with my courtroom background, you know, and a bit of a dose of cynicism, it's like there is fundamental. I mean, there is, if you really push the luck, you end up getting fined, right? You don't really want that because they can end up sort of docking your pay every week for the rest of your parliamentary term, right? And Natalie wouldn't be real happy with that, right? So you don't want to make sure. So there are, if you really go for the doctor, there can be some quite extreme results. But that hasn't happened in a long time, right? I think Nick Smith nearly got it happening to him, but that doesn't. So by the end of Parliament, right, and some people will be appalled by this, but, you know, it is what it is. By the end of Parliament, when I was no longer leader of the opposition, actually, I knew I was going because I'd done my dash, and I think I'd, you know, been finance spokesperson and foreign affairs spokesperson. With Trevor, you know, I just had a rule. I'm going to get kicked out once a week. And, this was not difficult. I'd just start taking points of order. They'd have no point to them, you know, really. I'd give him the borax, and, you know, you knew by about the third time you're doing that, he was going to be like out. And that was cool, because then I could go back to my office and watch Netflix or whatever it was I wanted to do.
Did you, once you left Parliament, did it feel, I don't know, how did it feel? Did it feel like there was a big hole in your life?
I reckon what makes a massive difference is how you go, i.e., are you going because you've decided, or are you going because you lost and you weren't re-elected, right? So I think that psychologically makes a mess of, you know, I got a bunch of pals who you know, they failed to win their seat or whatever and they're not back in. And that sort of, in quotes, haunts them, right? They always want to get back, you know, they want to get back because they've got unfinished business. Now, look, at a level, I could always say I've got a bit of unfinished business. You know, it would have been a privilege to be in New Zealand Prime Minister and some of these, but I'd been there, I'd seen it all, I'd been pretty high up. I'd done my time and I decided to go. And so I think psychologically knowing you're going on your terms makes a big difference. I think what's also true is knowing that, you know, I had some opportunities, right? If I was sitting here right now and, you know, it hadn't gone too well for me on the outside and I didn't have some meaningful work to do, that could be a real issue. Look, it was liberating, it was exciting, you know. As soon as I got out, you know, we were offshore for a little while on a kind of a holiday I hadn't been able to have for quite a long time. I knew I had a job to go to. You know, I didn't have that, but I can see how people do.
Yeah. What are the perks of being a minister that you miss? Is there anything?
There's only one thing, right? And look, that it's amazing they're not doing it anymore. No, there's two things. I'll give you two. Number one is the Crown car, right? And
oh, the
by
Beamer.
The way, you know, yeah, and they're using them less and less. And it's remarkable to me. But I tell you what, if you're a senior minister, you work friggin' hard and you are always tired. And You may well have been at a function where, you know, you're not getting drunk, don't get me wrong, but, you know, you'll have had a couple of glasses of wine or something. You should not be driving. I mean, I would have been a danger to other road users were I driving those situations. And being in that Crown car, say if you're the Minister of Transport or something, you're out in the regions checking out what's going on, meeting with mayors and so on. You know, that is an office, you know, that is, you're in the back there and, you know, I was pretty staunch, right? I think some of them would be chatting to the driver and, you know, listening to, you know, one of your many radio shows or something, you know. I was always working, right? I always had 10 phone calls to make. I had papers to read. I was a conscientious guy. So I think that Crown car thing was like a privilege, but it was an essential, right? And I'm telling you now, if I ever win the Powerball and get 45 million, I'm going to get a driver again, right? Because I think that's amazing. And then secondly, the other one that you don't get in opposition, you get this, you know, little room in Parliament, and the Parliament rooms are nice because they've got the wood panelling and so on. But what you get when you're back in the beehive is you do get your own dunny and shower, right? Every minister gets a dunny and shower, and that's quite a, you sort of want that, right? You're there long hours. You know, I don't want to be using the communal kind of ablutions. And so there'd be two for you.
Oh, that's good. What perks do you get for life? Is there anything anymore? Do you get domestic flights?
No, there's none of that. There was. I mean, you go back to the 80s and 90s, it was unbelievable. I mean, I think there was, you know, you still have the last of a breed who, you know, if they travel internationally, they only pay 10% of the fare. You know, but I assure you, in my case, there is zero left. You know, as I sit here to you about 2 years on from leaving Parliament, there is no remaining. I think the only thing I could think of is if I went to Parliament, I haven't. I don't think I literally have since I've been out. I could go and sit in the Parliament on the side, the actually in the house, as they call it. I think that's about the only remaining thing I'd sort of have left as a kind of a special treatment. Yeah, but there's no financial thing. All of that, the last of it died out with Key, actually, where he and I suppose the government I was a part of got rid of it.
Yeah, and from a personal, like, mental perspective, how have you been? It seems like you're feeling robust. Because I'm thinking of like Todd Muller, well-publicised mental health issues, Golriz Garaman at the moment. I mean, that shoplifting, that's got to be connected to mental health in some way because it just makes no sense. Yeah. What about you? Fairly robust?
Yes. I think I am a reasonably stoic kind of, you know. I think something about the upbringing, big family, kind of, you know, you get up every day. It doesn't really matter what's going on. You do the job. I think whether I am anymore, I think I've got a bit sort of fat and middle class. But, you know, I mean, I used to pride myself. I mean, I could live on a can of baked beans a day, you know. But I, you know, when I went through university, I had no money, you know, worked a lot of jobs and sleep much, you know. But then I still managed to do well at university, right? So I do, I suppose you're right. I have a perception of myself as a tough, robust guy who just gets on and does the business and doesn't worry too much about the emotions and all that sort of stuff. I think, though, that the slightly more interesting answer is, hey, you know, I can remember on those plane trips, you know, just everything had gone wrong all week. You know, you knew that half your colleagues were trying to do you and, you know, you hadn't handled X, Y, and Z very well. And, you know, you might be sitting there just quietly by yourself, pretending you're sleeping but wanting to cry, you know. And so I think anyone in some of the circumstances I found myself in would be in the same sort of situation. So I don't think... So I don't want to pretend it was perfect, and I don't want to pretend my response to some of the stuff over the years has been perfect, but I think I do feel, you know, again, this is the word we've used, but I do feel grateful that I've never, you know, there's been periods of depression probably, you know, due to the circumstance, but I've never had major mental health problems, which we know, you know, so many today do, and you know, it's so good that we talk about that stuff more than we used to.
Are you quite good at talking about it? Like with Natalie, like would you get home on a Friday afternoon and she's like, "How's your week?" And you're like, "Ugh, don't ask."
I was never good at it.
Yeah,
never. I was terrible. Got you know, walls? I'm like, you know, yeah, I think so. And I think, you know, the other thing is, you know, hey, because I've got an introvert part of me that's quite big, right? So, and you're out there as politician, you've just talked to like 1,000 people all freaking week, and you're just home back in Tauranga, or, you know, on Friday afternoon, and you just want to, you don't want to say another word, right? And, you know, you've got someone who wants something from you, and it's just like, how was it? Good? You know, any issues? No. Pass me that bottle, you know.
But
I tell you what I've learned more recently, and this is just something, you know, and it doesn't come natural to me, but I think I've got a bit better. I think Natalie would say I've got a bit better, and I've just got this thing. So we will have, you know, come home from work on Wednesday night. You know, maybe we manage to somehow miraculously get rid of the kids upstairs at some point in time. Cup of tea. I'll make sure in that, and this is nothing much, right? But I'll make sure in that cup of tea, actually, we're having a really good, meaningful conversation where I'm fully present, fully engaging. She is. We're both, you know, asking and answering, you know, questions in a full, genuine way. And look, most people say, "Oh, you whack job! Is that all you can manage?" But that's progress for me.
Oh, well,
that's progress because I'm a man. Yeah, you know, and men are a certain way.
And you and I are a similar age, and it's just not the New Zealand we were raised in.
Oh.
And it's funny because like vulnerability is a massive word now, and we're understanding that. Yeah, the more you can open up and talk about these things, the better off you are from a mental perspective. But like from a parliamentary perspective, it's definitely not there yet. Like if you're Jacinda Ardern and you show emotion at the mosque, that's fine. If you're John Key, show emotion at Pike River Mine, that's fine. But if you stand up there and say, "Hey, I'm not doing very well. Like a lot of people have been mean to me online. I've had some death threats." And you get emotional reflecting on your own stuff that's going on. People are going to be like, "This guy's not fit.
And I think it just there's a Kiwi aspect to it all, which, you know, I'm not even necessarily saying is entirely wrong, but it's like, oh, that's all a bit indulgent. You know, they're all about themselves. They're talking about themselves. And as a politician, you know, call me old school, but it's kind of like you're there for the people. You're there for others. You know, you're not there to be talking about your own stuff, right? You know, and so there is all of that with that, isn't it? You know, like I say, heck of a job. I'm glad to be out where I'm living a much more in quotes normal life. You know, you know, it's amazing how quickly people don't abuse you on the street anymore. They know you're out. You know, you can go back to a level of anonymity. You know the word I mean.
I'm going to clip that and turn that into
a meme. Yeah, again, slushies. Slushies and anonymity.
God, I should have given you a slushie today.
You so should have.
No, it's not a stitch up here. What about crying? Are you much of a crier? When did you last cry?
I think I do cry more than people. Because in a way, you're like, I'm all over the show here in this podcast, and you'll say, well, you just said you weren't. Like, in a way, you know, maybe we all are. In a way, I'm deeply emotional. Mm. Things can make me quite a... I'll tell you what made me really emotional recently, and maybe, again, this sort of says what a whack job. He's crying about something external that and a guy he doesn't even know. But I'll tell you what made me cry recently. Like really recently, as we recall this, is Alexei Navalny, you know, the opposition guy in Russia. And just, you know, because I sort of sit there and think, you know, your opposition leader was had its hard moments and, you know, and you felt on some days that everyone hated you and, you know, and that was just on your side and, you know, all of that. You just sit there and think about this guy. And I suppose it goes back to my childhood and I say that reading I did and, you know, that politics should be noble and, you know, it matters and so on. There's a guy, you know, who kind of like, a bit like, you know, if you're religious, Jesus in a way, knew he was going to die for what he was doing, right? I mean, this is not a smart game plan he had, taking on Putin every day and out mocking the guy, you know, and going at him and sticking up for ordinary Russians. So he ended up, and I can remember thinking about it before he died tragically, you know, but you know, the poisoning, and then he ended up in like the worst Eastern Bloc prison up in the back of where, you know, the treatment.
Like a torture camp.
You know, the treatment had been appalling, and the guy was exactly the same age as me, 47. And, you know, if you kind of put it in its mind, he died for his country. I remember the morning that happened, I woke up and saw it. Look, I don't know why, it just triggered something, me, and I cried. So it was about a month or two ago. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm capable of, you know, a good movie will make me cry still. Maybe something around my kids, you know, if it's not quite right or I feel like, you know, it's so. I probably do have a closet cry at some level every week or two.
But I do love that. I've had a couple of our peers on the podcast, Adam Perori, the former New Zealand cricketer, and Matthew Ridge. And Ridgie said he cries all the time now. Like he'll be driving in his car on his own, just reflecting on some things that he's like happy
about.
But
I can see he is and like I see this man in a different way. He's even more so with that sort of, what is he, Armenian kind of disposition, probably, right? But he's, you know, you can see that he is a passionate, emotional guy, right? I probably do a good job of hiding that and becoming more stoical. I think law and then politics kind of teaches you that rational side of the brain, but I think we've all got a bit of that, and I definitely have, and it comes out a bit, and probably now I'm more free and easy, it comes out more than it used to.
Yeah, you got any regrets?
I don't want to create a headline here, but you know, we've talked about, you know, one or two of them in my political career where, you know, I've said the wrong thing, and I think, but fundamentally, I always think it's a bit cheesy when people say I don't do regrets, but I kind of don't. I do think basically I got things right at the right times on the big stuff. I think I've learned over time, you know, I could be a bit clinical, you know. I'm kind of like, well, I've got the outcomes right. I'm trying to do the right thing here for New Zealand, you know, da-da-da-da-da. I think I've learned more good leaders. You know, I still consider myself at a level a leader, you know, not on that front line, but, you know, good leaders do have an empathy and an understanding of the people around. They do have good EQ, you know, they do have emotion. And you know, probably I could have brought a bit more of that to bear. You know, I talked about the interviews. That's just an example of this. You know, I got every answer right, but maybe there was a need for a bit more humanity. Maybe that's true on the gay marriage one, you know, for example, some of these things. So we're all learning, aren't we? And hopefully, like, I don't know if I'm getting better because I probably aren't. I'm probably picking up a bunch of new bad habits. But, you know, we're all learning and changing. If you're the same guy you were 20 years ago, well, you're a fuckwit, you know, actually. We've got to keep moving with and evolving and learning things and being surprised by things.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? You have old friends and, you know, they may want to go out drinking, you don't want to go, and they're like, oh, you've changed. And it's like, well, yeah, you haven't. You haven't changed. Who's the winner here? And second half of your life, what's that going to look like?
I just want it to be interesting, stimulating, and I suppose the politician in me, there's still a bit of that. I do, you know, I think people say, oh, what are you, you know, what is this about? Are you about, is it the fame, or do you, is it, you know, you were power hungry?
It's got to be a bit of ego, doesn't it?
There's a bit of, and there's always every For politician, sure. But I think what I do want is some significance, by which I mean, you know, a sense that I am doing something that matters for more than myself and will leave some form of legacy, you know, and you know, so I think, you know, interest, you know, loved ones, family, all of those things, but I think, you know, I still want to you know, I love New Zealand. I still do want to be significant in this country and be contributing, right? Not in politics anymore, but in other fields, whether that's business or, you know, or you know, through this NZTA role. So yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's, you know, all the super, well, not superficial, but all the good stuff you and I both want. You know, I got to look after my health so I get to 100. I'd like to make 100. Some people want to do it. I want to travel. There's 1,000 places I want to go with my family and show my kids these amazing places. So, the wrist was a wake up call, but I'm looking forward to the next 47 years.
How good! And you're looking very relaxed.
Life is great. Life is great.
Hey, thanks so much for your time today. I'm so pleased we connected and made this happen. And yeah, anyone that's still listening now, 1 hour 34 into it, I hope they've that you are what they thought you were, or they've got like a different perception of you for the better.
Hey, well, thank you for having me, Dom. Look, the check's in the mail because this counselling session has been outstanding. It's been a hugely positive, beneficial, therapeutic experience for me. But not all serious. So thank you for what you're doing. It's a great podcast, and you know, I know a lot of people get a lot of meaning from it.
Simon Bridges on the Dom Harvey podcast. What did you think? I would genuinely love your feedback on this one. You can get hold of me anytime you want on Instagram, DomHarveyNZ, or email me, DomHarveyNZ@gmail.com. I know politics is so polarising, so I probably try and stick away from it as much as possible on the podcast, but I don't know. I'd love to know what you guys think. Personally, regardless of what party someone's represented or is representing, I think it's interesting to get to know people, but ultimately this is the People's Podcast, so I'd love to know what you guys think. More of this, less of this, or just the same? What else is there? Housekeeping. Oh, hey, if your podcast app allows, mainly on Spotify or Apple, I guess, can you give the show a rating? 5 stars, preferably. And also, if it allows, leave a review about the podcast. That would be good. Also, if you're on YouTube, follow the account, Dom Harvey NZ. Videos go up each week of all the podcasts. Love to grow that listenership number. I think we're currently on about 4,700. Would love to hit that magic 5,000 subscribers. Hey, just before we go, thank you very much to the sponsors who made this episode possible, Radix and Generate. Radix is a Waikato-based nutrition company who are going mainstream in a big way. Their protein powders are world class. I start every single day with a shake made with their protein powder. And if you don't currently have protein powder, you should do some research, because chances are you could do with a lot more than what you're currently getting. And a shake with Radix protein powder is the best and easiest way to get more. But again, don't believe me, do your own research. Check them out, radix.co.nz. And while you're there, take a nosy around at their other products. Their freeze-dried meal range is absolutely insane. There is a very good reason that Radix have a 4.9 rating from 1,600 reviews. They are simply that hard to fault. This episode is also brought to you by Generate, the award-winning KiwiSaver specialist. When it comes to KiwiSaver, the majority of us probably signed up when we started working and then left it to run its course. Maybe dipped in to get some money out for a house deposit, but otherwise ignored it. But taking time to make sure you're in the right fund and ensuring you're maximising your account could really improve your lifestyle in retirement. And that is where Generate can help. Generate have a team of KiwiSaver advisors across the country available to meet with you, chat through your options, and help you make sure your KiwiSaver investment is working for you. If you have never got KiwiSaver advice before, head to generatekiwisaver.co.nz/Dom to request a no obligation chat with one of their advisors. That website again, generatekiwisaver.co.nz/Dom. A copy of their product disclosure statement is available on that website. The issuer of the scheme is Generate Investment Management Limited. And of course, past performance does not guarantee future returns. Hey, thank you so much for making it all the way through. Love you guys, and hope to see you next time on the Dom Harvey Podcast. See ya.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com. Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.